This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Simon Rollings. How are you, Simon?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Excellent. We're back at the Canned Wine Company and we're going to talk about canned wine, but I want to talk about some of the more technical aspects of the canning process. Because I did an interview with the guys from the tasting company about a year ago, and they fill satchels up, and I talked to them about their process and how they got it running so they had a good shelf life. And for them, a good shelf life is 6 months, 9 months, even a year on some product lines, but not all products could last a year in a sachet-type product. Yep. What's the life expectancy of a canned wine?
Generally speaking, I think it's probably around 12 months. We have wines that we've canned over 3 years ago now that still taste really good. And we're really focused on the technical aspects of canning to make sure that we have longevity in our wines. And there are some advantages to canning that potentially offer extended shelf life on certain types of wine styles. Of wine, so rosé, for example, often sold in kind of clear glass bottles, suffer from light strike, things like that. Mm-hmm. The fact that the wine is completely sealed in a can retains that acidity. There's no light ingress. So there are ways in which actually it could extend shelf life of certain styles as well.
Yeah. So I would have thought it would be a great product that actually could age very well in a can, but no one ever talks about cans being able to age, but yep. It does have that. So it's a humidity. What's the word? Humidity. It's completely sealed.
Is it hermetic? Is that right?
Hermetic.
Yeah.
Hermetic. You know, it's a hermetic seal, isn't it? There's absolutely nothing getting in there. There's no light, no anything.
Yeah.
So as long as the wine doesn't go bad because of that, it's normally, I would have thought it could be quite good. This week, we're going to look at a lot of the technical issues associated with canning and some of the problems and advantages. Last week, you mentioned that Sauvignon Blanc was not a wine that goes into a can very well. Do you want to just explain what the issues there are with Sauvignon Blanc?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not unique to Sauvignon, but any grape varieties that suffer from reductive tendencies, whether that's in bottle or any other format, it's going to be heightened by the fact that it's in a completely sealed, oxygenless environment. There's ways in which you can manage that by getting higher levels of dissolved oxygen into the wine before it goes into can. And the way we've managed that is by doing both that and using different grape varieties. Sauvignon has this kind of slightly additional challenge of containing thiols or high levels of thiols, which interact with the liners of the can, which can kind of degrade the can liner faster than it might otherwise have done with a different grape variety or a different wine. So you do see higher levels of failure in Sauvignon than you do in other grape varieties.
And when you're talking about shelf life, is it the lining? Because the wine isn't in contact with the aluminium, hopefully.
Nope, shouldn't be touching the aluminium.
What happens if the wine does touch the aluminium?
Depends on the wine, but you can get aluminium pickup.
So the wine has an aluminium taste to it?
Not necessarily. I don't think you'd taste the aluminium. The biggest issue in terms of flavor profile is when the aluminium reacts with sulfates in the wine and causes hydrogen sulfate, I think. So you get a kind of eggy, reductive, sulfurous smell in the wine.
And that's very common with, what, any wine or these wines with thiols?
That's any wine. So, the higher, basically the free SO2 will break down the liner and then it will react with the aluminium. And that's what causes that compound, that egginess.
But not bound, because just for the listeners, you got free SO2, bound SO2, makes your total SO2. Bound SO2 is the ones that have already absorbed the oxygen and protected the wine from oxygen.
Yes.
But the free SO2 is the stuff that hasn't.
Yeah.
And usually you want to have reasonable levels of SO2. If you're bottling in a wine bottle with cork, you need to make sure there's lots of free SO2 in there.
Yeah, because that will protect the wine. It will give it longevity on the shelf because you're getting oxygen coming into the wine. And so that free SO2 will bind to the oxygen and will protect the wine from oxidizing.
So does that mean that you need wine made with low levels of free SO2? Is that what you're looking for?
Yep. Yeah, that's one of the things where we kind of have learned and influence our winemakers, where they might typically maybe put free SO2 at something like 45, 50 parts per million for a bottle. We're looking at 20 or lower for canning. So substantially less free SO2.
We found that though with screw caps and Sauvignon Blanc, actually. I found it anyway. When screw caps first came out, some producers still used to put the old levels of SO2 in, and you'd land up with quite stinky wines. Sometimes it would blow off, because it hadn't gone through to those mercaptans, but sometimes it would
be ingrained within the wine. Yeah.
So, and the solution was just use a lot less preservative.
Yeah. And I think that's the learning point. You know, every packaging method is capable of holding wine, but you need to make the wine for the packaging. You need to understand how it's going to interact.
Do you think, just out of curiosity, do you think natural wines might be better in a can? Because often they don't put there's natural SO2 when you do an alcoholic fermentation, but it's very low, and these guys don't add SO2. So would they be a perfect product for canning?
They might be. It would depend very much on the individual wine. So we look at more than just SO2. We look at things like volatile acidity. We look at pH. We look at alcohol. We look at the relationship between free SO2 and pH. We look at heavy metals. So just by being low in SO2 doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work well, but it's one of the criteria that we look at when we're canning.
Okay, and just so to recap, the free SO2 in the wine reacts with the liner, and then if that liner breaks down, then you get aluminium in contact with the... What is it, the free SO2 again? Is it
Yeah, so when you kind of get the reaction of free SO2 and aluminium, you get the creation of hydrogen sulfide, and that is... you know, results basically in that kind of eggy, sulfurous matchstick nose that you get sometimes with faulty wines. Yeah. And it's obviously not a pleasant smell. Sometimes it'll blow off, but sometimes it's kind of ingrained in the wine. So ensuring that you get the right level of SO2 is one of the, free SO2 is one of the key aspects of canning.
And you said thiols earlier as well. Thiols are bad. What do thiols do again?
They accelerate the breakdown of the liner, or can accelerate the breakdown of the liner. So if there's particularly high levels of it, again, it will vary by grape variety. It will vary by region for Sauvignon Blanc.
And when you're talking about the ageability of a can, are we really talking about the ageability of the liner? Is that what the key thing is?
In terms of shelf life, yeah, if the liner breaks down, that's when you're going to get issues. Mm-hmm. But if the wine is technically correct, and this is from our experience, so, you know, fits within the criteria of what the liner is able to cope with, then your shelf life is much longer than what, you know, the can manufacturers would say. And that's why we're seeing 2-3 years performance.
And if I dint the can, does that impact the liner? So is a dinted can worse than a non-dinted can?
It could be. Not necessarily. But if you damage the liner, then you're going to end up with, you know, more issues than a completely...
sharp dint in there.
Yeah, it's going to cause more issues, exactly.
Leave it on the shelf for someone else.
Try not to throw them on the floor.
Okay. Yeah. Or if you do, drink it quick before the liner has a chance to get into it. Okay, no, that's fair enough. So we've talked about thiols and we've talked about free SO2. I heard that acidity can be a bit of a problem with cans as well. Is that an issue? Is it the pH level or what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, wine is quite a hard liquid to manage. Compared to beer, for example, it has very high levels of acidity and much higher levels of alcohol. You know, the liquid itself is a more challenging liquid than beer or potentially other pre-mixed cocktails or anything else might be. So again, you know, the more aggressive, the higher levels of acidity something is, the more it's going to eat away at the liner. These are all, you know, potentials. And what we're trying to do is look at, well, where exactly does that happen? So how much can we push the boundaries in terms of the spec in which a wine can be canned, because, you know, certain styles of wine are always going to have very high acidity. Rieslings or
Grüner Veltliners,
exactly. So we don't want to, you know, end up in a situation where we have very made wines because they have to fit within a technical spec. So it's about understanding what the limits of those technical.
And what's the liner made out of?
That is a very interesting question that the can manufacturers don't tell us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you can't even specify, like, I want a slightly thicker liner than you might use in beer because I've got this difficult wine to...
So we use Ardagh cans, and they have a wine spec can. Ardagh is the manufacturer. They have a wine spec can, which, as far as we can tell, is essentially just a thicker coating of the liner. Mm-hmm. So it's just more resilient for longer, essentially, than what would go into your Coca-Cola can or whatever.
But they're not. What's the really bad stuff at the moment? BPAs? Is it?
They're BPA free.
You don't know what it is.
No, so they're BPNI. So we know that they don't contain BPA, but they don't completely specify what everything is in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we kind of understand. It's their IP. They're protective of it. But equally, we need to understand more about it so that we can, test the limits of it.
And also, that means if you go to another can provider, you've got to go through all the process of verification and checking to make sure you've got the right product that will last the right length of time. So it becomes harder to switch suppliers, does it?
Yeah, so I mean, we do things like accelerated shelf life testing. We've used different can manufacturers and tested how they respond. I think they're all quite similar. In reality, we do need to test every single wine. If it's going into a different, manufactured can, then there's the potential that it will have a different variation in it.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about what eats away at the line, and we've talked about acidity, thiols, and free SO2. Is there anything else that you've got to worry about in the that might get into the?
Heavy metals. So.
Well, like some wine regions have got heavy metals in the wines.
Yeah, and some wine growing or making styles. So copper sulfate is a spray used in organic farming. You get higher levels of copper in soils, and so higher levels of copper in the end wine with organic wines. That's why we're not organic across our range, for example. So some regions make sense for organic. So our wine Garnacha comes from northern Spain. It's very arid. It's very dry, organic farming. But it's not labeled organic and so on. So it really depends on the region and the wine.
And do you find that when you're looking, because I know, for example, that the organics and the biodynamic guys, they have to spray a lot of copper sulfate on because copper is, it's a heavy metal pollutant. It stays in the soils as well. It doesn't even
run away.
Once it's there, it's there and they're chucking tons of copper in there. But do you actually see that coming through as that heavy metal into the wine itself?
Yeah, you can see it. You can see it come through into the wine. And so, it's being very careful in terms of the analysis of the wine and understanding, if the copper's there, why is it there? Where's it come from? If iron is there or any other heavy metal, again, where's it coming from?
Strangely, you say that, but copper is one way of cleaning up mercaptans and those stinky smells when you do get reduction. Copper is why a lot of stills are made of copper, is because sulfur reacts with the copper and it takes it all, and then it doesn't get into the final product. When you're making a whiskey, you're concentrating everything down. And all of a sudden, if you concentrate all your, is it hydrogen sulfates and all those sort of things, the copper reacts with them and they stay in the still and not into the final product. So it's actually, copper's a really good product when you're stilling, but not in your wine, you're saying.
Not in the finished wine. So it can be used for fining for some of the reasons you just said. So could leave traces or whatever. So we just need to be careful that the levels are very, very low across all heavy metals, really.
Yeah, yeah. And do you see any other heavy metals?
We test for iron. We test for a few other different heavy metals as well and try to keep them below certain levels.
Okay. Copper is a bad one or is it just as bad as iron? Or
I think copper's the worst.
Yeah.
I think you see high levels of it more frequently because it's used as a fining agent. It's used as a spray. It appears within wine making and wine growing quite frequently. But you see the other metals as well. So
okay,
and I think it's still early days. So in terms of how long people have been canning wine, I think it was originally 100 years ago, but really it's only been the last 4 or 5 years where there's been real uptake of the format and people doing it. So actually getting testing over a 10-year horizon and really understanding how each of these different elements interacts and how they interact relative to other parts as well.
Yeah.
We'll be able to kind of develop this understanding as we grow.
One of the issues is you mentioned earlier was reduction, and that's oxygen. And oxygen doesn't get into the can.
Yep.
And oxygen can be quite a good thing in terms of managing some of these boiled cabbage, egg type flavors. And you said some of the wines you dissolve oxygen into the can. What's one of the issues I heard about cans was one of the advantages you've got if you put lager into a can is because it's fizzy, as you fill it to the top, CO2 is coming over the top. And when you put your lid on top, because my understanding of the basic forming of a can is you have a base, you have a round a sheet that you round up, you attach it to the base, you fill it up, and then you put the top on.
So the base and the sides are all one piece.
They're pressed. Yeah.
And then you spin it to seal it.
Yeah.
Seal it round is the basic way of doing it.
But all right, so you got your base and the sides, all one piece.
Yep.
Of course, if you look at a can, there's no join at the bottom. And then if it's fizzy, CO2 comes out the top, and then you put the top on. For a lager, that means almost no oxygen in the final product because CO2 is coming out and there's no room for the oxygen to get in.
Yeah.
But you're saying you actually want the oxygen in there for certain styles of wines?
It's one of the challenges. You know, canning lines have essentially been created to ensure that there's no oxygen ever in contact with the finished product. You know, come out of brewing and, you know, lots of other drinks as well. You don't want that because you don't want it to spoil. But wine actually, in lots of cases, benefits from some micro-oxidation. We have five wines, three of which are oaked. So putting it through some oak aging stabilizes the wine. You get some micro-oxidation in there. But part of that is about managing the wine in order to go into that environment where it's going to have access to less oxygen. It sounds about being less careful, but actually understanding that a bit of oxygen into the wine is not necessarily a bad thing compared to something else. So when you are transferring between tanks and putting it onto the line, you know, a bit of oxygen pickup's not necessarily a bad thing.
So what do you do? How do you do that?
You know, for one production run, we offloaded without a CO2 cap into the tank. So actually proactively got some oxygen into the wine, which can bring down free SO2, and it can also open up the wine a bit before it goes into can, because essentially once it's in, you're kind of capturing that moment. There's not loads you can do at the end. So it's more about the winemaking process up until the point where you're filling. But once it's in, you're kind of capturing that moment. So we want it to be ready to drink. We don't want a scenario where someone has to open a can and wait 2 hours for it to open up like you might with a bottle. It's possible that at some point in the future, you know, people might get to that stage. But realistically, people are going to open the can. They're going to want to drink it there and then.
Yeah.
So it needs to be ready to drink. So it needs to be bright, fresh, open. You know, you want to open the can. You want to get aroma straight away coming from the opening. So, you know, all of these things we kind of pay attention to when we're going through the process of canning it and transporting the wine.
Yeah, okay. And what other problems? Is there any other problems associated with the canning process? Nothing you want to admit.
it's a good question. Are there any other problems with the canning process? I don't know. I think the main problem really is not a problem, but it's just, as I said, it's early. And there's lots more research to be done. You know, we have the challenge, but also the great aspect that our wines are vintage led. So every single vintage, the specification will change slightly for each of the wines. Mm. The weather that year will affect the acidity. It will affect what level of SO2 might need to be used in the winemaking process to protect the wine, and so on and so on and so on. So every year it's a slightly moving challenge. But that's what makes wine interesting. It's not the same product every year.
Yeah.
It does vary. And so just understanding those things is key. And we'll progress that understanding more as we do more vintages, we hold wines for longer, you know, all of those.
Have you guys looked at larger cans? I mean, you can get pretty big cans out there. 500 mil is quite a common size. But you're at 250, some are at 200 for a single serve.
Yeah.
Have you thought about large cans? Is there any different issues associated with larger cans?
People ask us surprisingly often. We think the main advantage of the can for us, alongside sustainability, is that you can bring down the price point of something really interesting. By being in a 500 ml can, you're not going to bring the price point down very much compared to a bottle. So we like that idea that you can have a smaller amount of something really, really good, and that you can mix and vary what you're drinking more. And again, from a sustainability perspective, the CO2 reduction that we spoke about previously of 72% is per litre of wine. So even four cans or three cans is better than one glass bottle from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So the gains of going into 500 ml, we don't really see as hugely interesting. have two 50 mil cans, in which case you can have two different wines or two of the same. It doesn't matter. But, you know, we see the advantage in it being smaller format and a kind of wider consumption trend, certainly within the UK and possibly other countries as well, which is that people are generally drinking less. Where they are drinking, they're looking to drink something better. And so by going up in size, we think we kind of move away from, generally speaking, how people are looking and wanting to drink alcohol.
At the moment, do you use one company to do your canning in one place?
We do at the moment, yeah.
Yep. And do you have plans to expand that either into new territories or new canning lines, or what's the story there?
Yeah, so I mean, the most sustainable way to produce anything, including bottles, is to bottle, can, fill at within the market that you're operating in. It's much more efficient to bring bulk wine to the market and can it there than it is to bottle in Bordeaux and send it in bottle everywhere else around the world.
Mm.
At the moment, we do all of our canning at a site in Italy. And the reason for that is there's a huge wealth of wine making knowledge and understanding in Italy compared to the UK at this point in time. And so we get that real kind of technical expertise that we need as a canning company, but ultimately we'll bring production back to the UK for the UK market, obtain EU production for the EU market. And then if we expand beyond that, we'll look at other solutions in other territories as well.
And do you sell your product in other countries other than the UK at the moment?
Yeah, they're for sale in Greece, in Ireland, hopefully shortly in Sweden as well. So we're growing.
But not Italy?
Not Italy, not yet. Need an Italian wine first for it to sell in Italy.
So I presume you guys are trying to get into all the Nordic monopolies.
So the Nordic monopolies are kind of proactively pushing cans. Yes. They have criteria quotas within their buying for System Bollinger, for example, in Sweden, where there's a reduction in CO2 is a kind of key criteria of the buying there, which is interesting. It presents a kind of quite exciting opportunity for the Nordics and, you know, Norway as well.
And they like premium products. That's the thing, is they're not after, they don't want cheap booze. They want premium products that to help discourage consumption in an environment.
They do, friendly. Although the buyers don't want to pay for it. I think that, yes, there's a premium or an opportunity for a higher price point there, but the market needs to catch up slightly in terms of what the expectation is from the buyers for the monopolies as to how much a premium product costs in a can.
Yeah.
We're getting there. We're talking with lots of people in those regions, and hopefully we'll launch there soon.
Cool. All right. And outside of Europe, any markets you're thinking about? The US?
Yeah, the US is an interesting market.
Gravestone of many a British entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the US and Canada, I think, in terms of...
Canada, because they've got lots of monopolies up there as
again,
well.
Again, the monopolies. In terms of the markets, quite innovative, the US... was certainly viewed as being ahead in wine canning. I'm not so sure if that's true anymore in terms of innovation and diversity and what's on offer. I think there's been a real push in the UK particularly for lots of innovative startups coming through with interesting products and wines and styles. Mm-hmm. But certainly the US is a market that is open to cans, less traditional than perhaps the UK and other European countries.
There isn't a lot of barrier to entry, though, is there? You know, you think about it, you're outsourcing your canning, so anybody can source product, get it canned, put a nice label on it, and then compete with you guys in a fairly even way. You know, there's first mover advantage, but you haven't quite got that, because I think Uncommon came out before you guys, didn't they? But their product is quite different in terms of what they're flogging.
The biggest advantage we have is the technical understanding, which we developed over multiple years of doing it, which I just told you.
All the secrets.
Without too much detail.
Yeah.
But no, it's the technical understanding. It's the, you know, the supply chain, the winery relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And then the biggest barriers to entry are really from a business perspective. So it's how do you get scale? How do you get scale through distribution in the UK? In the Nordics, it's through the monopolies. In Canada, it's through, again, the monopoly So, you know, it's actually, they're the key pieces for cracking that aspect of it. Yeah.
All right then, Simon, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Great.
Cheers very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris.